The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning, how are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement, and I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie, on the Radio Kerry app, or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. Now, we are going to have our another episode 3 of our documentary Come West Along the Field, and we're getting a great reaction to that. That was produced by Connie Broderick and I, and Connie took the lead, and we're coming into Kerry now in these episodes with the field, so that'll be in the next hour. We've lots more besides, but it is this time of year again where the birds are starting to create that wonderful music called the Dawn Chorus, and who better to talk about it than bird watch expert Tom Lynch, originally from Dingle, and he's on the line to talk to us now. Good morning, Tom. How are you? You were saying to me there off air, we've a bit of good weather, a spell of it anyway. So is that good news or bad news for the Dawn Chorus?
Oh, it's certainly good news. Good morning, Joe, and good morning, Joe listeners. Heavy rain and all that is very bad for a nesting season and Dawn Chorus and all that, because a lot of chicks and a lot of nests fail when there's heavy downpours or rain. So dry weather is good for birds, it's good for everyone, it's good for farmers, it's good for the mood of the public in general. So it's great that we are going to have a bit of dry weather for the next 7 to 10 days. And even though the Scottavine has stopped at that on the 15th, and there comes from Colliffe and the Gook, the bad spell of weather associated with the coming of the cuckoo. But it's kind of can be mixed. Scottavine can be mixed. You can have showery, cold weather, and then you can have good days as well. It looks like we're going to have the first part of it now, we might settle in, and we might have a fairly good Scottavine this year. Who knows? The Dawn Chorus has certainly began, and it's, I suppose, it begins in a way back in November, December. You've song thrushes and things starting to sing, our own resident birds start to sing, and then as the season moves on, as they move into spring, they're joined by other migrant birds that come in. But you, anyone, wherever you are, you probably have a blackbird, a robin, a wren, maybe a grey tit, starlings, song thrushes and things like that, chaffinches singing around your house, or even if you open the window in the morning early, you'll hear those. And as the season progresses and you go into March, sand martins come in, and they're followed in by things like swallows, house martins, black caps, chiffchaffs, widow warblers, grasshopper warblers, and of course the cuckoo, who kind of comes around the first, second week of April. And if you have white throats, although they wouldn't be that plentiful in Kerry, but there are some in East Kerry, North Kerry, and places. And then along the coast, your wheat ears, known as Tlochran, and in Oscar, you get that they nest in burrows and under stones and things like that. And the last of all to come then in kind of May would be the swift and the spotted flycatcher. And the swifts are very much an urban bird. See them around towns. They nest in old buildings, fairly tall buildings that go in under the slates or the tiles. You'd see them around Tralee, Granny, small number in Dingle, Kinmare, places like that, Lisdoor. But they wouldn't be in yet. Now they'd be kind of May. But the Dawn Chorus itself, it's all about territory. The reason the birds are singing is that it's very nice for us to listen to, and it's relaxing for us. But it's very, very serious business for the birds themselves. Yeah. And the main reason, I suppose, is to proclaim territory. The male usually does the singing, and they go around the boundary of a sort of an imaginary territory and saying, this is my land. It's saying to another male, if you come in here, I'm going to fight you, I'm going to chase you off. And they're singing to their own, like blackbirds are singing to other blackbirds, robins are singing to other robins, and each species is not worried about the other songsters except their own species. And they're having to judge who would win the struggle by the strength of the song. How long they can sing for and so on. And the best singer gets the best territory, and the second best singer gets the second best territory and so on. And they're also singing, of course, to attract a female or to a female on the nest. And in some cases, to attract more than one female. Wrens, for example, male wrens might have two or three females on this. And when a male is singing, he's showing he's not sick, he's not hiding from predators. It means that he's in good physical health. It also means his territory is providing all the food he needs and perhaps a good surplus of food for the female and her chicks. And the longer and more melodic and really the song becomes, it's a sign to a female that the particular male has been around the block for a few times. He's good at looking after himself, he's good genes, and so it makes a good parent or a good father. Singing is in a way for birds to form a fighting and aggression and perform to sort of impress the ladies. And as well as that, the singing at dawn, they're singing when it's kind of dark and a predator can't see them. And there's nothing else really to be done at that time. They can't hunt for food either, so there's a bit of that in the dawn chorus as well. No, I'd say to people, maybe don't get too caught up if you're kind of new to this or you don't know a lot about, don't get too caught up in naming all the species. Blind if you want to do that, there are lots of YouTube videos and things like that. You can kind of teach yourself the songs. But you can also sort of immerse yourself in listening to the musical performance, like listening to an orchestra. Some people go to a concert with an orchestra and they listen out for the different instruments, the violins, the violas, the cellos, bass instruments, and so on. And they'd like to identify every single one. But most people, when they go along, they just listen to the orchestral piece. So I'd say if you're in a woodland or if you're just listening out your window or whatever, let the song wash over you. Forget about your worries for a few minutes. Think of loved ones which you are far away, or maybe loved ones who have passed on, or think of things that are good in your life.
Yeah.
And enjoy the performance, because it's not performed for our benefit, but we certainly benefit from it. And in ancient times, man sort of knew when the birds were singing that they were safe, that there was no big predator in the area. So it had that soothing effect, and it still has.
Yeah.
You know, if you let the sound in.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way of looking at it, Tom. But something that's come into my head there, and I don't think I've ever asked you this. Like, you're mentioning the male kind of, you know, performing and kind of attracting the female. Is the male a better singer than the female? Or are they the same?
In most cases, it's the male that does the singing. Now, I know the females do sing and have sub songs and so on, but in most cases, I suppose the dawn chorus is backbone in a way, for me anyway, by the male blackbird. And you see them, they perch up and they sing this lovely, fluty song. And it's wherever you are. The robin is another one. The robin sings, but he stops and he listens to see where is the neighbouring robin. Is the neighbouring robin encroaching on this imaginary territory that they have? And the wrens, they sing sort of in the hedgerow, roughly, not very high up, and it's at our own kind of hype level. And they have this powerful song for a spotted bird, and there's a little trill at the end of it. And the male wren builds a few nests, and then he brings a female around, and she inspects the nest, and she'll choose one, and she'll do it up to her own liking. But he doesn't let the other nest go to waste, because he brings other females around to the other nest, and maybe he might have two or three females on the go. Just something that I just saw there during the week. Michael Harding said this years back. He was talking about songs and ballads in time of crisis. And he said, I think it's very appropriate at the moment, we haven't a clue what may be still to come, so we must leave it to the wild birds this spring and summer to cry in the wind in the hills and woods and hedgerows or in gardens in suburbia, assuring us that the heart of the world still beats with unbending love. It's very proper this year of all years. No one knows what is to come, but so enjoy the present and the songs and the fine mornings. And you know, we just chorus as well, of course, anyone that's not early, too early in the morning. As the evening moves on, the birds again sing, proclaiming their territory, still saying, I'm here, you know, it's the same reasons. So you can enjoy just chorus as well as the down chorus.
Yeah, has it ever been adapted to music? You mentioned the orchestra and everything else there. Like, has it inspired, I wonder, musical pieces?
It has. Yeah. There are several, if you go on and Google or YouTube, there are several. There are actually two kind of songs that come to mind. John Splane and Pauline Scanlon have a lovely song called The Down Chorus.
Mm.
And it's there, and anyone wants to Google it, it's on YouTube. And Australia, we have a lovely song, which is a number of us in Kershuk. In Irish, we have two words for the blackbird. The male blackbird is called the Lumbov, and the female is called in Kershuk. Even though some people say that's a thrush, but they're a member of the thrush family, but it's the female blackbird.
Yeah.
And they're two lovely songs in there, and they're definitely inspired by the Down Chorus. But then, if you go on, you'll see that. But Birdsong has been incorporated into lots of musical pieces, and it's used as a background for people reading poetry and for different things. It certainly influenced musicians, and even the names of tunes in the traditional tunes. You have the Skylark Reel, you have the Blackbird Set Dance, several others, the Morning Thrush, which is another reel. So the musicians were probably more aware than a lot of others about the music that the birds were making, and you know how much there's the famous tune, The Lark in the Morning, which is said to have come from two musicians were competing with one another to see who had the most tunes, and they played every second tune. And if one played a tune, the other couldn't play that, they had to play a different one. So they played on through the night, and one guy played a tune, and it was up to the second guy to answer, and he couldn't think of any tune. So he said, to kind of take a break for a minute, he went out to the door, and he heard the lark, Skylark, singing in the sky. And he came in, and his voice had composed this four-part jig, The Lark in the Morning, and that won him the competition. You know, so that this song of the bird and the music, or traditional music particularly, are very, very interlinked.
Yeah. Tom, stay with us because we have to go to a break. You're a font of knowledge. I don't think there's any question I can throw at you where you don't have an answer for it when it comes to birds. Tom Lynch is with us. We're going to take a break and we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
Now, I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. I'm Joe McGill. This is the Saturday Supplement, and it is the time of the dawn chorus this time of year. I'm delighted to say Tom Lynch, birdwatch expert, is with us, Dingle native, of course. Tom, we were briefly talking about the dusk chorus then as well, that's a thing as well. And what's kind of what's going on there for the birds?
It's the dusk chorus is probably the more or less the same. The words that you hear with if you're up early in the morning, the dawn chorus, those same words will be singing kind of from 7-8 o'clock on in the evening as they settle down for the night. Again, they have kind of fed up, they've fed themselves during the day, they've fed their chicks or whatever, and then again they're laying claim to their territory. They're telling the other of their own species in the area, I'm here, I've survived the day, I'm settling down this patch for the night, you keep out, keep your own, don't come in here. So you get this lovely chorus, maybe not as crystal clear, it depends where you are, in the sense that if there's like you probably would have more traffic than you would have traffic sounds and noises, you know, at that time of the evening than you would have, say, very early in the morning, maybe 5-6 o'clock in the morning, things can be very, very quiet, and the air has this Christmas crisp sort of a feel to it that you kind of hear the bird song. Maybe a bit more alert as well ourselves in the morning, you know. But the dusk chorus is still a lovely time to take a stroll in your local area, or just sit out in your garden, or go to a woodland area or a bogland or whatever is near you, and just walk around, and you'll hear plenty of bird song. You know, even simple things like the swallow, the twittering of a swallow on a wire or whatever, sounds like a little wind-up clock work tie or something like that. It was like then ones that are easy to recognise, say in Woodland there is a Chiff Chaff, because they actually say their name. They say Chiff Chaff, Chiff Chaff, Chiff Chaff. They're easy ones to learn. Song Crush is an easy one as well, in the sense that whatever the Song Crush says, it repeats. If a Song Crush says, "Cherry Doo," it would repeat it at least once, maybe twice, three times. It'll say, "Cherry Doo, Cherry Doo, Cherry Doo, Cherry Doo." It may change the phrase then, it'll say another phrase. The older the bud, the more phrases they'll have. They'll learn as they go on in years. And, some birds are a bit easier to, as I said, the blackbird is great because it perches up. You'll nearly see it singing, and it's easy to identify. Blackbird, yellow beak, and it's lovely, a real strong, fluty song. Easy one to learn. The robin, again, to be very close to you, and they're the ones that out at the wren, things like that. Then, as you go on, there are other ones that depends where you are. Like, I'm sure everyone knows the song, the cuckoo, two notes.
Yeah.
Cuckoo. Now, people do mix it up a bit with what has become very common in recent years, the collared dove. But the collared dove has three notes. Collared dove says, there's three notes in that. Cuckoo, two notes.
Yeah. I've often done that myself where I've made a mistake. Yeah. Because you kind of think, oh, that's the cuckoo, but it just sounds a bit off or something. Yeah.
The collared dove has three notes, and they do say, he's a United supporter. He's saying United. Three syllables.
Yeah. We're talking about these beautiful birds and, you know, the wonderful music they make as well. But it's kind of their foundation is in a bit of aggression. Like, I was looking at this documentary recently. It was on ostriches. And they don't know why ostriches do this, they were saying in the wildlife piece. Basically, they were picking up young and they were throwing them around the place, these young male ostriches. They were picking up the young chicks. And I mean, they were being violent with them, so much so that some of them lose their lives because of it. Like, but there's a lot of aggression in the kind of bird world, isn't there?
There is, certainly. Like, even to take the swallow now that it would be fairly common around, carrying around Ireland. Swallows sometimes will actually kill the chicks in a neighbouring nest in order to start a new nest with the female.
Whoa.
So there's that happens, and that's there. There is aggression, and then you have birds like the magpie. The magpie actually goes around and searches. It's the only one that does this. Actually searches for nests of other birds in the hedgerows and so on. He goes along, and if he finds it, we take the eggs of the chicks and feed it to himself or to its own chicks. And now the hooded crow will do the same thing. Another bird but they don't actually search, but the magpie actually searches and watches. He watches the smaller birds, a robin or a wren or a blackbird or whatever, where's that bird going? And he sees the bird going in and out the same place, there's a nest in there, and it actually go in, seek out the nest and kill the chicks or take the eggs or whatever.
Wow.
So there is a lot of that there. Now, another thing, of course, we'd say to people this time of the year, if you have a cat, put a little bell on the cat. It does give the birds a chance to hear the cat coming. Or if you can, keep it indoors as much as possible, especially if it's an indoor cat. Sometimes cats can be very happy indoors and don't go out too much. And there are cats. I know a lot of cats have no interest whatsoever in birds. They just see them as something they can catch.
Mm.
But then again, the other side of it is, and a lot of birds, the most, I'd say, slaughter borders are done by cats, because that's the cat's nature. You can't blame the cat for that.
Yeah, and they bring them back as presents as well. I've witnessed that myself.
Yeah.
In relation to kind of on that theme as well, and I remember talking to you about this before, like the cuckoo is an awful so-and-so from even birth, because it uses its bottom to heave out another egg inside in the nest with it, like.
That's right, yeah. The male and the female cuckoo work in tandem. They usually in Ireland they use the meadow pipit's nest, but they can use a robin's nest or a stone chat's nest or some other nest, which is usually 9 out of 10 would be the meadow pipit, kind of nests on the ground. And what happens is that the male cuckoo will fly by, and if the male cuckoo resembles a bird of prey, so does the female. So they, small birds get up to mob it and chase it away. Mm. So the meadow pipit will get off its nest to chase away the male cuckoo, and so will the other small birds in the area, and they think they're doing a great job because the male cuckoo takes off and they go off in a wild goose chase after it. While she's off the nest for maybe only a minute or two, the female cuckoo pops in and drops in an egg into her nest. Now, sometimes when the meadow pipit returns, they recognise the cuckoo's egg and they either throw it out or they leave the nest and they start making a new nest somewhere else. But very often they don't. And when they don't, the cuckoo's egg hatches out sooner than their own. And the young cuckoo, the first thing it does is throw all the other eggs out of the nest. Wow. Throw chicks as well, but usually chicks wouldn't be there. It'll throw out the eggs and it will have that nest to itself. And the meadow pipit foster parents will feed that cuckoo, and not alone will they feed it, but it begs so much, the other birds in the area, when they're passing by, pop in a bit of food as well. Because it has this yellow gape and it keeps begging for food. And this, it does the sort of begging going on, and it's like someone keeping asking you for something.
Yeah.
And eventually it's not sure to give them something.
Shut them up.
So that is how the cuckoo survives, and the young cuckoo never meets its parents, never.
Yeah.
Until it never again. It doesn't see other cuckoos, maybe until it reaches the wintering grounds in the Congo or whatever, sub-Saharan Africa. You know?
But they know, so they do know they're a cuckoo, don't they? Like, in the light of instinct of what they do. They don't think they're the other bird.
They have different routes for going back. Depends on where the cuckoo is born. A lot of our cuckoos, they go down to the kind of along the northern Mediterranean, and they feed up there, then they cross the Mediterranean, maybe a place like Italy and so on, and then they go into Africa, and then from there they go down and they winter kind of in the Congo Basin. And then they know this now from the tags, they have satellite tags on a number of cuckoos, and I think the one in Killarney, the Corries, was missing for. She was ringed in, or he was ringed in Killarney National Park, and he was missing for most of the winter. They couldn't pick up any, nothing from the satellite tag, but they picked it up there a few weeks ago, and I believe the bird is on the way back, well on the way back, in France or somewhere at the moment. Yeah. So it's on the way back to Killarney National Park.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They have learned, they kind of come to us in a kind of on a western route, and they go back on a kind of a more eastern route.
Mm.
That's the Irish cuckoos. Now, cuckoos in different parts of Europe go different routes. But it's just important for them to, I suppose, that they need, especially on the way back, they need a sort of feeding stations, and they need a certain amount of, to put on a certain amount of weight before they give up crossing the Mediterranean,
Yeah.
A lot of dry land and deserts and so on, you know.
Yeah, a layover, Tom, an extended layover. Tom,
yes, exactly.
Stay with us, because after this, we're going to be talking about a very special event as well that's taking place as part of Féilín na Bealtaine Around the Dáin chorus that Tom will be involved in. And we're also going to be talking about the Puffin, because during the week, it was International Puffin Day.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney. Serving the finest seafood in a cosy, modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. We're talking all things birds this morning with Tom Lynch. And we will be talking about Tom as a very special event going on in his native Dingle around the Maybank holiday weekend for Féilín na Bealtaine. But before we talk about that, Tom, I was on to you during the week about International Puffin Day. It took place during the week. I didn't even think there was such a thing. But the puffin, for Kerry especially, it's a very significant bird, isn't it?
Oh yeah, who doesn't love the puffin, the pallet of the sea, and people associated, you know, the puffins come back here in spring to breed, and they come to places like the Outer Blaskets, the Tíreach, and Inishfickillan, and places like that, and then Skerry Michael, of course, and Puffin Island, they're just off Port McGee, and they come to other parts of Ireland as well, you know, Cliffs of Moher, for example. The only place you can see puffins nesting from land is at the Cliffs of Moher. Anyone that's ever up at the Cliffs of Moher, if you walk up to the cliffs and you go left instead of going right for O'Brien's Tower, and you look down, go left for about 100 yards, and you look down to the little island called Goat Island, you'll see the puffins nesting there. Now, the puffins, they nest in either in a burrow anyway, either a ready-made burrow, or they dig out a burrow in soft dirt, or they find a cavity between boulders, or they might find a shearwater nest. And they go in, they nest in there, and it's just one egg, one brood. The whole lot is invested in that.
Oh, yeah.
There's one chick, and they're just so colourful. When you see them in flight, it's just plain black wings and the little orange legs, but they have a deep triangular kind of bill patterned blue, grey, orange, yellow and red, especially in the adults in the summer. And then they have a disc-like grey, white sides of the face and a dark eye and black upper part and neck and white underside. When they fly, they have a kind of a fast, direct, low, quick wing beat, whirring sort of a flight. And sometimes they fly, generally they fly fairly low, but sometimes they may fly higher over the sea when circling a colony to come back in. But in winter, we don't see them at all because they go off out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
Now, the only time you'd see them in winter is if they're blown in by a very bad storm.
Okay.
And they'd be blown inland, but that'd be rare enough.
Where do they go out there? Are they just flying around?
They go out there and they rest on the water and they fish.
Whoa.
They're just tough, hardy. Now, some of the young puffins in bad storms get washed up and washed up dead.
They're
not able to survive the storm.
Yeah.
If you get a really, really bad Atlantic storms, they wouldn't. Some of the young ones, particularly some of the older ones as well, wouldn't survive it. But they are tough, they're hardy. If you're near a nesting colony, you'll hear this. They have a kind of a cooing growl, kind of a sound that they make. They wouldn't be the best singer in the Don Quixote if you were looking for a singer. But they breed along the west coast of Ireland. But they breed in places like the Salties and Rathlin Island and places like that as well.
Mm.
But the puffins breed kind of from Iceland all the way down to kind of northwest France. They're not a very big bird. They're about, we'll say, a foot long or a bit less than a foot long. You know, 29, 26 centimetres, that kind of thing. And they have a wingspan of maybe 2 feet, we'll say, you know, around 60 centimetres, maybe a bit less.
That's interesting, Tom, because I actually thought they'd be smaller than that, that they'd fit in your hand. But because when I was in the Blaskets Centre, they talked about the locals going as far as the Skellig's Island to actually hunt puffin.
They'd
eat them. Yeah. So that means they'd be like bigger than a chicken almost, you know, to eat.
They would. I mean, as I say, they'd be from the tip of their tail to their beak, they'd be about a foot.
Yeah.
Just a little bit less than a foot. Think of a school ruler.
That
kind of length. And they'd weigh about 300 grams to 500 grams, depending on what feeding they'd have.
Yeah.
They feed on sand eels and squid and things like that, you know. They do say that puffins in Ireland are generally doing okay, and they're able to find that type of food that they always lived on. But in Scotland and places where the fish have drifted kind of further north because of the global warming and climate change, they have to go too far away from the nest to get the food. And they eventually wind up abandoning the nest and the young chicks die in the nest. Or else they have to feed them kind of incorrect food. They feed them things like pipe fish and so on, and the pipe fish, the cotton in their claws are too bony.
Yeah.
They die from that. It seemed to be doing okay in Ireland, but their status would be that they're vulnerable. Like, you know, that their numbers have decreased. I don't know about that. There were counts, for example, of the Outer Blaskets of 20,000 puffins going back maybe 30-40 years ago. There wouldn't be anything like that now. You'd be down to the low thousands now, you know.
Yeah, and the one egg, I suppose, doesn't help with their survival rates, does it?
Well, it's the one egg, like, but as you see, birds are that way, like.
Yeah.
It's really if they can find the fish to feed. To feed the young, you know, and feed themselves as well.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it comes down to that. They're funny birds, in a way. They're funny to watch when they hide their beaks and bow their heads when they want to make friends with each other, and newly mating pairs rub beaks together. Yeah. Kind of a courtship display. And then the boat, people go out on boat trips and so on, they form rafts on the water with other seabirds. You know, you'd see this group going along together,
yeah,
and the boats try to sneak up beside them, get people take photographs and so on.
Yeah,
but they'll fly off in front of the boat, you know. Some of them return to the same burrow that they used last year, or the year before, you know. They like islands because they nest in an island. You have less predators. You have no foxes.
Okay.
You have no rats, goats, things like that. However, mink have got in to some of the islands, and the mink create havoc. Any of those, you know, rats are equally as bad because they'll get into the burrows and they take the eggs and they take the chicks and so on. A burrow is safer as well from the birds of prey, in the sense that the chick can't be got by the local peregrine or the local sparrowhawk.
Mm.
If the chick is down inside the burrow, or if it's out of the burrow and it can run back into the burrow, that's the beauty of the safety of having a chick in a place like that where predators can't get at it.
Yeah.
But the
Guinness used to have the bird, the pecan, wasn't it? I think are they related? Because people often mix them up, even though they don't really look like. It's more the colours, I suppose.
They'd be more the colours. The Guinness. Guinness has a toucan.
A toucan,
you can a toucan or something.
Yeah,
a peacock,
yeah,
yeah, and you can yeah. toucan or that was part of the ad. Guinness had one too.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of people use the puffin as a logo, and even in gift shops, little, you know, as ties for children or as earrings and souvenirs and all that. You'd often see the puffin being used because people just have that affinity with the puffin. I tell the colours, and it kind of looks funny, and kind of a small little, I don't know, man or a little kind of, and it waddles along as well, you know. So
yeah.
Now people that go to Skellig Michael as they walk up, you get very, very close to them, but you wouldn't put your hand to them now because they have quite a sharp, that beak is fairly sharp, you know. People have to learn to that cost not to put your hand too close to them.
Jeez, yeah. But you shouldn't be interfering.
You will, on the walk up to the top of Skellig Michael, get very, very close. They're used to people there as well, and they stand out and watch.
Yeah.
But people
absolutely love them because, in my brewery, we have them on our glass, and someone actually got, an American tourist saw the glass and they got a tattoo of the puffin exactly like we have on the glass and sent it to us because people absolutely love them. They just love them.
They do, yeah. And internationally loved it, say, you know, but
yeah.
Americans, our own, they're just, the colours and the, I suppose, people go to the Skelligs and go to places just to see the puffin.
Yeah.
And there could be lots and lots of other species of seabird around them that they wouldn't remember the day after they saw them, but they'd remember we went somewhere and we saw a puffin.
Yeah. I must talk to you about the gannets as well the next time, but we don't have time now because they're a fascinating creature as well. There's a cartoon and an animation, a book as well, about the puffins, Osgeilge as well, which is brilliant.
Several.
Yeah. So, Tom, stay with us and we'll talk about this wonderful event you're involved in for Failing at Beal tonight, but we'll talk to Tom after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963. You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now, Tom Lynch is still with us. And at the start of the programme, Tom, we were talking about the Dawn Chorus. And you have a very special event with regards to the Dawn Chorus for Failing a Bealtaine in Clochdeida, my mother's old secondary school.
That's right, on the 2nd of May at 6:30 a.m., new to my wife and myself, and leading a down chorus for Phil and the Bills and the grounds of Clash DJ. And again, as you, your mother would know, you probably know yourself, there's a lot of woodland around Clash DJ. And so we'd be hoping to hear woodland birds and the common birds there, and maybe a few of the migrant birds would be in as well at that time. The whole theme of Fair in the Bowls this year is birds anyway. So they're having that event, they're launching, booked in by Gordon Darcy, the famous author and artist, called Bird Styles, that evening as well. May the 2nd at, I think it's 5 o'clock up in the Frisco Room in the T-shirt. And the Fair in the Bowls in a parade the day after. As the theme is again is going to be birds, and the primary schools along the peninsula have been working on arts and crafts to display in this parade under the guidance of Ruth Carberry. So that should be a very, very colourful parade again, the bird theme, and that's continuing on then with a film after that on the Corn Crake up in the Sacred Heart University at 2 o'clock. And after that they have the famous man Sean Ronan, the guy who did that film Bird Song and the book Nature By. He's in the Sacred Heart University from 4 till 7 o'clock with a talk, and I think they're showing the film Bird Song. But anyone that wants to see Bird Song, all they need to do is go on to RT Player and it's there. It's well worth, if someone is interested in Don Chorus and bird singing, it's well worth sitting down for the 5 minutes or whatever it is and watching that programme. It's a really lovely programme.
It's beautiful looking.
Very well put together. And I actually should mention as well, while Derry Nan, Vincent Hyland, had a lovely piece during the week on the Down Chorus and Birds. Anyone goes on to Facebook, on his Facebook thing, there's a lovely little bit on the
Down Chorus
and the different species, the common species really of the Down Chorus. A lot happening with birds at the moment.
Yeah, and getting back to your own event, so remind people when it's on, and what, do they need to bring anything in particular, like binoculars, or like what do they need to bring with them?
Well, it's on at 6:30, May the 2nd, 6:30 a.m. Down Chorus, and all they need to do is come along, bring themselves. But if they have binoculars, it'd be great. Bring along binoculars. We'd be really hoping for a fine morning. It makes all the difference. If you get a fine, dry morning, it makes an awful difference. The birds still sing when it's raining, which is, I don't know, puts a damper on it. And a windy morning is not great. Too much wind. The birds tend to stay down from the wind. They sing a bit, but not like they'll sing in a nice, calm, fine morning.
Yeah.
You'll hear them better. They'll sing better. Windy, wet morning. Not a good morning for a down chorus. So we'd be hoping that the fine weather of the next 7 to 10 days will carry on into May, or at least that we get that morning fine anyway.
Yeah, I presume you leave the dogs at home, do you? Like for something like that?
We all love dogs, but really for an event like a down chorus and so on, you're better off to leave the dog at home, because if the dog runs off ahead, the dog, if the area has dogs all the time and the birds are used to the dogs, won't affect it as much. But a place like Clash D, there wouldn't be many dogs around them. If 9 or 10 dogs appear early in the morning and start barking and so on, that upsets the whole. It upsets the enjoyment of it anyway.
It will
scatter the birds as well.
And I presume you'll be describing what you're hearing and all that.
We'll be trying to pick different species, and we'll be trying to give people kind of clues on how to identify the song. Little things like, for example, we'll say, just something that springs to mind, the blackbird, the difference between a blackbird, we'll say, and a missile thrush. The song of both is very, very similar, except the blackbird sings and stops, whereas the missile thrush sings, stops very briefly and starts again. So they say like that, if you were a secretary taking notes, the blackbird would give you a time to write down the note, whereas the missile thrush would, you'd miss pieces because he'd be going on too fast together, you know what I mean? You'd be saying to people, if those two birds were there, I'll listen to the difference. See, that bird is keeping going. That's a missile thrush.
Yeah.
That bird is stopping. That's a blackbird.
Yeah.
You'd be trying to pick out the wren because it's close to you, you know, that kind of thing. The robin, the common ones, really. And then, you might get something like a willow warbler, something like that singing, and again, there's little things about that. Essentially, it builds up to a crescendo and then dies off. It goes and then it's gone.
Yeah, excellent.
So it's going up the scale and yeah. Then suddenly it's gone.
Excellent. A nice way to finish. Brilliantly taking off the board there, describing the board and the sound of the board. Tom, do people just rock up to that? I presume they don't have to book anything, do they?
Oh, no, it's free.
Yeah, brilliant.
It's free events. Right. Just come along. As far as I know, they can check it on the failthebelton.ie anyway.
All right, Tom, thanks a million. An absolute pleasure as always. I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thanks, Joe.
Now we're going to take a break for the news at 10. And in the next hour, we're going to be hearing our third episode of Come West Along the Field, documentary about the River Field. We'll take a break for the news at 10, and I'll join you again in the next hour.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan's Seafood Bars. Packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today. The Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now we're into the second hour of the Saturday Supplement, and I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. I'm Joe McGill with you on this Saturday morning. And Tom Lynch, you were listening to him before the break, and he was on to tell us all about the Dawn Chorus, and we were talking about the puffins and everything else, because it was International Puffins Day during the week. And Tom just messaged me to say he forgot to congratulate Carlo Flaherty on his new book, Up the Field and Over the Bar, A History of Dingle. CLG, just published last week, and he said it's a massive book, and to give it a mention. So I've done that for you now. So well done, Carlo Flaherty, from Tom Lynch. And also, while I'm at it, I want to say hello to someone very special that listens to this programme every Saturday morning, and that is Kathleen Hickey. Kathleen, I hope you're doing well, and I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. A little birdie taught me that you listen to the programme every Saturday morning. So hello to you, and I hope you are well. Now, as you've been hearing over the last few weeks, we have a new five-part series, Come West Along the Field, following the River Field from its source in the boglands of North Cork all the way to the Atlantic, exploring the landscapes, heritage and communities shaped along its course. And now we're into the third episode, and in episode 3, we're along the middle stretch of the field around Abbeyfield, a part of the river shaped by history, community and change. You'll hear stories of past floods, how the river supported local life and the pressures it's facing today. A stretch where past and present really meet. So have a listen to this. This is episode 3 of Come West Along the Field.
This documentary was produced by Connie Broderick and Joe McGill and is funded by Cumasun na Mban with the television licence fee.
As we previously discussed, the river rises in the healthy upland area where the bogs and the natural vegetation help to maintain good water quality. But the tributaries, like I said, also provide clean, well-oxygenated water for our rivers, and that creates good riffles, glides and pools for juvenile fish growth. So some of the main tributaries around here would be the Oveg, and then we've got other small tributaries like the Aegon and the Glashconcourt. The river also, as it widens, it offers a range of habitats, so you've got your faster runs and your deeper holding pools. And that's where our adult fish can live. And, you know, that provides good angling opportunities. So we've got a good history and a good tradition of angling here in the middle section.
After flowing from Rockchapel through Mount Collins and Brusna, the field reaches its middle section. Here it winds through lowland farmland, edged with woodland, gravel riffles and sweeping bins. The mix of moderate gradients and well-developed pool riffle sequences make it prime water for salmon and trout. It's a landscape rich in history and memory, carried by the flow of the river itself.
About a half mile up from Fieldsbridge is the Glashconcourt River. It rises in Loch Fodder and flows for about 5 miles down into the field. It's the Spate Stream as well. It means the river of the long-headed eel. That's what the local farmer told Paddy Elias at one time when he asked him.
Here at Fieldsbridge in Abbeyfield, a crossing point steeped in history on the Kerry-Limerick border, we hear from local historian Larry Begley.
We're here at Fieldsbridge now, built in 1812, called the Wesley Bridge, after Lord Wesley, who was Governor of India, and Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, and he was a brother of Wellington. it replaced the old road, which went up through Mayne of Buchan and straight into Cashflanand. When this road was built, Abbeyfield was became established. There was a great flood here in 1858, and the bridge got blocked. The water backed way up the river. There was a downpour in Rockchapel. A flash flood came down the river, and they were caught, and they ran for their lives up to the main line here. There were 21 houses. The flood rose up to the roofs of the houses, and people scampered up on the roof. There was a man called Tim Sullivan, swam in, and he rescued 11 people off the roofs of the houses, and he got an award from the Humane Society of Ireland for his bravery. Now, this was a very contentious area in the 1840s and 50s and 60s. You had the Protestant church built here. The fellow that built the church in Brosna, Sylvester Moriarty, didn't look for a place here. And when he got the house anyway, he got Norman to come here, Reverend Norman, eventually. And Reverend Norman built his church, and he built a school beside it. Why over Creamy, Fieldsbridge Creamy. And further back, you have a subsidiary of that Creamy, Headley's Bridge, which closed down when they joined Kentuck, North Cork Co-op and Kentuck. And that takes in a few suppliers all the time. That was famous. They opened up for making cheese.
Yeah. As we go over here, are we going into the townland of Nottinghamshire this side?
Here. One time there was a road coming from Castle, and it came back here, just beside the bridge there. As you went into Kerry, there were 12 standing stones there, like Stonehenge, but then some of them were taken away or something. And it continued on, there was back to Dingle. It was called Clydeove Naraha, the black ditch of misfortune, or fortune, or whatever you call it, Naraha. All the travelling was done in that ditch. There's a Protestant graveyard here then in front of the West Lane, across the road from me. Just over the road here is a monument to Captain Coyle, who was shot in the Civil War. Further up with the Glenna and the Turrilagan River meet, and they come down and join with us here to find the old way.
Beyond Fields Bridge, we come to Nottinghamshire, once part of Brosna Parish until it became a parish of its own in 1916. Just outside the village, we come to another tributary of the Fíl, the Ollmhéig, a Spate River that rises in the hills and runs north to join the Fíl. Though small, it is an important salmonid stream, with salmon and trout using it as a spawning and nursery ground.
That's the river that was harnessed there by the mill to run it. Further up in Lochford, coming down from there, is a little river called the Mean, and Dan Breen made it famous in his story, My Fight for Irish Freedom. And back the river here for that joint, it's called Lyra Gawn.
Bill Morell is a founding member of the Nottinghamshire Angling Club. Now known as the Nottinghamshire Angling and Environmental Association, its focus is on caring for the River Ollmhéig, protecting spawning grounds, improving habitats, and keeping the river alive for future generations.
The club started in 1987. When the club started, it was obviously Nottinghamshire Angling Association, but as you notice now, it's Nottinghamshire Environmental and Angling Association, because to be honest, the majority of work that's done by the members at the moment is to try and look after the river, upkeep the river, upkeep the bounds of the river as well, and hopefully we manage to encourage things to come back up. It was a good trout fishery at the time, but that unfortunately has died down. The problem with sea trout is your fishery is only good as whatever comes into the river. The amount that we're getting up in Nottinghamshire now, I'm afraid, is fairly small. We do have brown trout, which of course don't travel backwards and forwards, but we are very, very dependent upon what gets into the river in the first place, and the levels of water when the run comes. We also actually get a very good run of salmon. The problem with that is the run of salmon we get is outside of the fishing season, and it was really coming up to spawn, and actually the top of the Ollmhéig and its tributaries is still to this day, thank God, a very good spawning area for salmon. So what in fact we did in the Ollmhéig was we put in some small dams here and there, which we call collected the gravel. What you did was that the water coming over the dam dug a hole over a period of time, and the smaller gravel stuck in there, so it made a good spawning area for fish. So at least we are doing our bit to try and keep the river alive.
Bill describes where the Ovig rises before joining the Feel, and the wildlife you might encounter along its banks.
It enters the Feel, if people know the area of course, just downstream of Fields Bridge, and then meanders its way up to, again, Headley's Bridge, which most people seem to know. Once you get to the other side of Headley's Bridge, you break up into various small tributaries, which is where the good spawning beds are. You have a lot of very small little tributaries there, which come down and join, become the main river at Headley's Bridge. And then you have another tributary, which runs down the back of Knockmaddoshall Parish itself, or the village itself. You have two joinings. As a local name, is just known as adjoinings. If you say that the water is coming from an arc from Knocknarvarshall to Mean, anything that drains there is eventually coming down into the Ovig, into the Field tributaries. Basically, the most wildlife you see, we have had kingfishers, a few otters. Of course, our friend the minks are around as well, I'm afraid. A lot of little waders and such like that will be down there as well, especially round by the rivers. We have a good few hares seem to like to come down by the side of the river as well. So there's a lot of wildlife along there. And the great thing is the farmers in the area are brilliant as well, because they leave the edges of the banks alone so that wildlife has an area where it can develop, which is brilliant.
We have seen maps from the 1500s, 1600s, where the names that are given on the maps is actually Nephela. So the Feel name in some aspect has been even as far back as that. It would have become more synonymous with the format of Monaster Nephela because of the abbey. And then, of course, that was changed in because of the English having a stronghold here as well, then became Abbey Feel, or the Abbey of the Feel.
Continuing downstream, I come to Abbey Feel, a traditional market town on the Kerry-Limerick border. It's here, in the foothills of the Mullacharargs, that I'm joined by Maurice O'Connell, chairperson of the Abbey Feel Community Council.
So now we're just entering the Abbey graveyard here in the square in Abbey Feel. We're standing in what is today known as the Abbey graveyard in the middle of Abbey Feel. There's probably no more than an acre of ground. And it's unusual in the fact that it is one of the very few continuously used graveyards in the country for over 800 years. And the exact spot where we're standing now is where the very first building was in Abbey Feel, the Cistercian Abbey, which was built in 1188. If someone stood here 1,000 years ago, all that you would see horizon to horizon would be native forestry, oak and ash. One of the things that the monks wanted was they wanted security, so they had to find a secure location. Not far from here, probably less than 100 yards behind the buildings in the square, you have the River Feel. Unlike today, where rivers do not have an abundance of food, at that time you would have fresh, clear water coming down from probably the Rock Chapel side, where it originates, and there would be an abundance of fish, so that would be the food and the clean water aspect. And of course the other side of it as well is not alone have your security from your native forestry, but where you have a lot of oak and ash, then you have an abundance of firewood for heating and also for future building as well. So they were self-sufficient, you know, and they had security at the same time. And that was probably the main reasons why they set up base in Abbey Feel at that particular time.
The River Feel has always been central to Abbey Feel, giving the town its name and sustaining the community through the generations.
The River Feel, how does that play? Well, obviously hugely important from a fresh water and a food perspective when it comes to the fish, etc. A lot of our generation here who are in their 90s in particular tell a very similar story about the importance of the River Feel in Abbey Feel during the 1920s, 30s, 40s and 50s in particular. Because this was a relatively economically poor time in Ireland. A lot of people were immigrating from Ireland in general, including this area. But a lot of them referenced the fishing was so productive from the river feel. They are liking it to the same as what industrial estates are today in this town. So the river feel was the economic viability for the people living here to the same extent as the hundreds of people working in factories in the town and other towns in the area.
And we'll say the fish within the river that were taken, were they taken further than Abbey Field? Or were they sold here directly in Abbeyfield?
They're taking some of the fish themselves for their own households. But because there was such an abundance, there was actually a number of agents in Abbeyfield town. And the fish would be brought in on when they were done, they were boxed. And then you'd have the guys from the, even as far away as the Dublin Fish Market, they'd either be coming down or they would be sent by train up to Dublin. And there was two forms of payment. I've heard stories where the agents would be able to put a price on the box of fish that was coming in on the day from each fisherman. They would give them a price there and then. But I've also heard stories where the people themselves, some of them felt they would take a chance, they might get a better price if they mailed it directly to the Dublin Fish Market. Now, this is something that probably wouldn't be done today. And they'd ship it. And the honesty and the respect was so high at that time, the guys in the fish market would give them a higher price, they'd send the money back down and they'd collect it here in Abbeyfield, whatever it is, a few weeks later or whatever it was, you know. But there was a continuous flow of fish. There was so much of it, as a matter of fact. I've heard stories from, again, from people in their 80s and 90s, where the train from Tralee, Listowel, that was coming on to Abbeyfield and Limerick, would make impromptu stops near Port Castle, where I'm on about now, where there was so much fish coming out of it, they didn't want to be hauling it back to the train station there before, and the drivers of the trains would understand that, and they'd just stop and allow them to put them onto the wagons before they came into Abbeyfield. The River Feel is the reason why Abbeyfield, like any town or village, started to begin with. There's many reasons attached to it as to why the towns and villages flourished during that time. Hugely important.
That's the first part of episode 3 of Come West Along the Field, produced by Connie Broderick and I, and Connie took the lead on this. We're going to take a break with more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals, available in store.
Now let's return to Come West Along the Field. This is episode 3. And this is part 2 of episode 3, and we're around the area of Abbeyfield.
Abbeyfield is steeped in music, and each May, the town celebrates that tradition with Fla by the Field.
Every May, there's Fla by the Field, but outside of that, Abbeyfield would be considered the epicentre for the Slieve Lucre type of music. Now, it's interesting, because the Slieve Lucre, we talk about when you go back up the field, the River Feel more or less supplies the water for the Slieve Lucre area all the way along, you know. There's definitely a very unique style of music that comes out of here. When the Fla by the Field is on, they're coming from all over, and we have visitors that come in from America every year for it as well. And we have a number of families here who have become well known and have a number of albums recorded on the back of the Slieve Lucre style, and that could be traced back to the 1700s, 1600s, from, I suppose, starting with poetry and the type of music that was there at the time, and it has developed and developed and developed, you know. But definitely Slieve Lucre music and Abbeyfield are more or less coexistent.
So my name is Catherine Hayes. I'm the Fisheries Inspector with Inland Fisheries Ireland. The tributaries of the field play a vital role in shaping our river's health and our biodiversity. They feed the main river with clean, cool, oxygenated water, which we talked about earlier, for salmon spawning. And they also create a network of habitats where fish can spawn and young fish can live. And they support a rich variety of both aquatic insects, plants and other wildlife like the otters and the wagtails we talked about. And the tributaries also help to regulate our river flows, and they reduce the risk of flooding, and they bring in nutrients to sustain our river's food webs and our overall ecosystem health. So some of the main tributaries around here would be the Aulachán that comes from Tuirnafulla, the Ula that we're next to here that comes in just downstream of Abbeyfield, and it would be a place where we would regularly check for spawning salmon during the wintertime.
Two tributaries join the Feel around Abbey Feel. The Aula Conn, stretching some 14 miles from its source through Turnafulla and Timpaglenton, reaches a town where it passes under a fine three-arch bridge beside the cattle mart before joining the Feel. The Aula, about 7.5 miles long, rises on the slopes of Sugar Hill and marks the boundary between Ate and Timpaglenton parishes before meeting the Feel less than a mile west of Abbey Feel, near Buckley's Cross. Together, these rivers add character and strength to the Feel as it flows on.
So the Aula rises up probably around Drogheda. It doesn't flow through any major towns or villages, so it probably is one of the rivers that's, you know, one of our pristine tributaries for the Feel. Like I said, it has a good stock of spawning fish in it. So in the wintertime, again, you know, we walk the rivers to see how many reds would be in the river, and you know, because we do that every year, we'd get a good indication whether it was a good year for spawning or a poor year for spawning. But the Aula would be one of the tributaries that we would always check to, you know, to indicate whether it was a good spawn or a poor spawn. Angling on the river would be negligible because it is a small stream. Angling wouldn't be a pressure on the river here.
And how would this compare in terms of the Aula Conn that flows in just closer into the town?
I suppose probably similar systems. Maybe the Aula Conn would come through maybe more intensive agriculture. Comes through, you know, the village of Turnafulla, so that does have a tertiary water treatment plant up there, so maybe slighter impacts for water quality there. But again, probably very similar systems. They both rise in uplands, like the Aula Conn rises up this side of the Mullica Arcs. Again, another important tributary that we have for spawning salmon. Again, probably the bottom of the Aula Conn has some angling on it, so if you go out past the March Bridge or go out past the next bridge up, there is some angling there for salmon.
Beyond its tributaries, the Feel's middle section supports a remarkable diversity of life. Katrin tells us more about the species that thrive here.
So our riparian woodlands and meadows, they provide vital habitats for otters, which are a key species, again, protected under the Habitats Directive. And they rely on healthy fish stocks and undisturbed banks for their survival. So they make their holts, their homes, in the banks of our rivers. We also would have a lot of kingfishers in this section, and you know, they feed on the small fish and the aquatic insects along the margins. But invertebrates, so the insects that live in the river, and they're the food of our fish, their diversity is high too. So we'd have a lot of species like mayfly, stonefly and caddisflies. And they're important as indicators of water quality. And like I mentioned, they're the food of both fish and some birds as well. Wooded riverbanks and meadows, they act as buffer zones, and this will help to filter runoff and to stabilise banks and maintain good water quality. In terms of water quality, it's the EPA, and they conduct regular biological surveys of rivers to determine the Q values. That's based on the presence or the abundance of macroinvertebrates, so the insects that live in our river. The insects are used as biological indicators because they're very sensitive to pollution. So we've got a lot of insects who are very sensitive to pollution, so like your stonefly, your mayfly and your caddisflies. And then you've got some insects that are more tolerant of pollution, maybe like your worms, your midge larvae and your hog louses. I think I mentioned already that the majority of the Feel is a Q4 status, but the EPA has designated the Feel as a priority area for action due to the amount of pesticides that's in the river. And recently LAWPRO, so that's the local authority's water programme office, they had a public meeting in Listowel to discuss the priority area for action.
What impact do water treatment plants and agricultural runoff have on the water quality in the Feel, and how is this being addressed?
So water treatment plants and agricultural runoff are two of the main pressures on water quality, especially in this part of the river Feel. In 2024, the EPA said that nutrient pollution from agriculture and urban wastewater remains the most significant issue. For wastewater treatment plants, they contribute nutrients if the infrastructure is outdated or overloaded, particularly during heavy rainfall where stormwater overflows can occur. So a lot of our small towns and our villages have been growing, but unfortunately our wastewater treatment plants haven't been growing in conjunction with them. However, Uisce Éireann are looking to update their wastewater infrastructure, and nationally IFI have had a huge input into this priority list with Uisce Éireann. Then on the agricultural side, was the field catchment is vulnerable to diffuse pollution. So that's maybe nutrient runoff after slurry spreading, or maybe from poaching of riverbanks. So that's where, you know, cattle have free access to the rivers and they're able to go down to drink water and walk up and down along the streams, and that's causing, you know, sediment load to get into our river. This can lead to, as I said, nutrient levels increasing, so phosphates and nitrates, and also sediment getting in.
That's part two of episode three of Come West Along the Feel. We'll hear the final part after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
St. Vincent de Paul is looking for volunteers in Killarney to help with home visits. I'm Niall and I give a couple of hours each week visiting people in their homes who are going through a tough time. With the rising cost of living, many people are feeling stressed, lonely and isolated. Sometimes just knowing someone cares and is there to listen can make a real difference. To find out how you can help, visit svp.ie/volunteer.
Spar Red Value Savings have landed. Get them while they're hot. Capri Sun Orange Drinks 10 by 200ml multi-pack, only €3.50. Tato Hunky Dory's 130g range, any 3 for €5. And Cadbury Caramel Crunchy and Dairy Milk 4-pack bars, any 2 for €3. Enjoy a bag full of Red Value right now, under the tree at Spar. Offers available in participating stores while stocks last until April 20th. Customer quotas may apply.
Are exams coming up in your house? This Tuesday on Talk About, Deirdre from Horan's Health Stores will join us for the Good Health Guide, where she'll be chatting about natural supports, from supplements to wellness tips, to help restore calm, stay focused and exam ready. That's the Good Health Guide, this Tuesday on Talk About, brought to you in association with Horan's Health Stores, 21 stores nationwide.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now let's return to part three of episode three of Come West Along the Feel.
The middle section of the Feel is shaped not only by water, but by farmland, with dairy and beef farmers working the land along its banks. How it's managed makes a big difference to the river.
IFI, we would collaborate closely with initiatives like ASSEP, so that's the Agricultural Sustainability Support and Advisory Programme, that's run by Chagas, and also with LawPro. So we do a lot of engaging farmers to carry out voluntary measures to reduce nutrient runoff and to improve water quality. And we contribute at a national level to ASSEP and LawPro so we can have actions that will support fish habitats and biodiversity. Another key area that we look at is we input into a lot of planning and licensing. So we review maybe drainage maintenance plans or farm development proposals to ensure that measures are in place to protect our fisheries. So if a farmer like maybe wishes to address an issue in a river or a stream or a drain that's on his land, we would rather to be consulted before the action is taken so that we can devise the correct action plan for that farmer to address the issue, rather than having to come along afterwards and deal with the fact and maybe go through a more serious route. So like where it is necessary, we do carry out enforcement to address pollution issues or illegal work such as gravel removal. And we can also cross-report to the Department of Agriculture. It's called conditionality now. And that's where there's breaches of farming practices and farming standards, and a farmer's single payment scheme may be affected and he would have reduced payments then because of our conditionality report.
My own name is Timmy O'Sullivan, and last year I've just been voted in to become the secretary of the club, so I was nominated for the role, which I've taken on and which I'm enjoying really in the club in the last 2 years.
Alongside the scientific monitoring, the Feel is also watched closely by those who fish its waters. Timmy O'Sullivan, secretary of Abbey Feel Anglers Association, introduces us to the club and its place on the river.
When the club was founded, I can't tell you, but I do know that my father was the chairman of the club for years, Paddy O'Sullivan, and he took over as chairman of the club in the 80s. The club has been a very productive club over the years. We've had many, many members. At times, we even had up to 150 members plus in the club, which was great to see. Today, I brought you down, Connie, to a place we call Rillahens. On the way to the Wa, you come to Kilcar and you turn down in this club waters. It's roughly about a kilometre of left bank fishing. Very, very productive fly fishing area. Lovely gravel on the left-hand bank where you fish. Would be very suitable to train young fishermen how to fly fish and how to spin. The Abbey Field anglers have a lot of fishing really from the bridge of the football field in Abbey Field down as far as the Wa Bridge. We don't have all the fishing, but we have certain areas of fishing in that distance, you could say. From the bridge down around the football field, which is known as the Joinins, it's where the Yellow Horn meets the field. A very, very good and productive area as well. for both salmon and sea trout. Sea trout in the months of June, July, and maybe into a bit of August. And then you come back here to where we are today, kind of Kilmorna, where we have Rinnehan's, as I say, that kilometre of left bank fishing. And then on the Kilmorna side, we have a place called Connell's Flats, it's called. That is right bank fishing. And again, very, very productive all the way down as far as the bridge and the Waugh. Fly fishing is probably the more preferred option around here, really. You don't get too many more spinning at the moment. People come, you can get a day ticket in the club, you can get a weekly ticket in the club, and you can come and enjoy your day's fishing. And again, I say the most productive time to do that is after a flood. So you do get a lot of day tickets and a lot of weekly tickets to members that wouldn't be from this part of the locality. They'd be up in the Galway area, maybe up from parts of Clare, and they'd come down and they'd look maybe then for a bit of information of where are the best places to fish when they come down. You know, we'd give them a map of the area of where you come in and how you come into the fishing and explain the rules to them. It's catch and release, obviously catch and release. You can only fish a double hook for the fly fishing, and not a triple, they're all gone now, it's only double hooks, and they have to be barbless. So you can return the fish in a good state back into the river. The type of fish that are most prominent in this would be the Irish Atlantic salmon. Anytime from the months of April right up to the end of September when the season closes, if you get the proper water in the river, you can meet fish in any stretch of this river, really. You know, it's really, really productive. Not as productive as it was back in 30 years ago when I used to be going fishing with my father, and you were guaranteed to catch either a salmon or a trout the day you were going out, and in those times you could keep them. But with the way the decline has gone in the numbers, probably a lot to do with out in the ocean, where they do make their trek every year when they go back into the ocean to make their trek back again. They're being eaten up by these big trawlers probably and all this kind of stuff, you know, out in the ocean. So it's not as productive as it used to be. We've good members in the 75 members or 76 members that we have, and we'll keep the club going, keep doing what we're doing in the club, I think, because what we're doing, I think, is right. As you know, this is a Spate River, and with the Spate River you really need the flood, I suppose, really, so that the fish can come in from the Atlantic into the field, you know. We did have a bit of a flood on Saturday, so today now the flow has dropped. And it really drops very quick. The water drops very quick when the land soaks the rain, you know what I mean? When the land gets waterlogged, that kind of keeps the river up. So if you have a lot of rain and the land gets waterlogged, it will keep the river up. But other than that, you probably have a week or 10 days after a flood where the river is at its most productive. Health-wise, it's a very healthy river, I would say, at the moment. You know, it's a peaty kind of a river. You can't see through it, you know what I mean? There's peaty colour in it. But very, very healthy, I would say, at the moment.
Timmy O'Sullivan knows the field well. He's seen how the river keeps changing. Sometimes suddenly, sometimes slowly, but always leaving a trace.
The river actually changes here quite a lot, you know, with the floods that come, and we're seeing more and more floods now. There was a really, really big flood in every field there. The record for the highest flood in every field, which was set back in 1942, that was actually broken with that flood. In every field, we had water that was halfway up the goalposts in the football field. So you can imagine what that was like the further back towards Kerry you got. And you did see all the news programmes where back beyond the Stole and Killacrim and more places where there was a lot of houses and everything flooded back there. A lot of the banks are being eaten away. If you have a sandy bank or an earthy bank, they're taken in the flood, you know what I mean? So I suppose the erosion would be a big thing, really, you know what I mean? There's parts of the river where sometimes there might have been great width to that part of the river, and now, because of floods and because of erosion, it's taken away. You more especially see that below at the Waugh Bridge. I think there's a photo going back there from 2010, just at the bridge there, where the water comes down and it flows into the right-hand bank and it turns at a 90-degree bend. We have a photograph from 2010 and a photograph of 2024, where there must be definitely 30 feet of that high bank gone. It just been eaten away, really. So I suppose that's the big thing, the erosion, really, in different parts of the river, and how to stop that, trying to stop that land being eaten away.
Protecting riverbanks is never simple. Catherine Hayes of Inland Fisheries Ireland points to projects on the middle section to show what can be achieved.
So we have been advising for a more nature-based river restoration method, so moving away from that typical rock armouring or rocks and river that you would see. So probably one project that we've had here in the middle section is actually on the Agon stream. So that's the river that runs through Tipperglenton. Limerick County Council were completing a bridge replacement, so they removed a barrier, but they also had to do some bank protection to protect the banks around the bridge, and they used a technique called willow weaving. So that's where willows are woven between living uprights and then backfilled, so the willows can grow in the banks both vertically and horizontally, thus stabilising the eroding banks. And that's like a natural solution to the problem of riverbank erosion. And that was a very good example. It's probably there maybe 3 or 4 years and it's holding well. It's not the solution for all riverbank erosion, because in very, very high energy systems, like on the main river field, they may not actually hold.
Barriers in that are identified on the river, what plans are put in place when they're identified?
So in relation to our barriers, we have the new barrier mitigation division, and they will rank the barriers. So they're not only ranking the barriers locally, like on the river field, but those barriers in the field then have to be ranked in a national context, because obviously there's only a finite amount of money there to remove some barriers. So currently in the Shannon River Basin District, we have a project based on the Mulcair River to look at the removal or the remediation of the barrier in Anacotti on the Mulcair River. So there are currently no plans for any barrier on the river field. But that being said, there are quite a number of barriers that, you know, may in future be addressed by the barrier division.
From crossings and communities to the tributaries that renew its life, the field's middle waters are alive with history and tradition. In the next episode, we carry on with this section of the river, following its flow towards the village of Duwall.
Yeah, that's Come West Along the Field, produced by Connie Broderick and I. And like I said, Connie took the lead on this and he's done a great job. We'd like to dedicate this programme, Episode 3, to the memory of Bill Morrell, who featured in this episode and gave so much to his local community and the river he cared deeply about. Ar yesh de gurev a anam. And we'll have episode 4, the bank holiday weekend for you, the May bank holiday. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. Now we'll take a break. And after that, we'll be remembering 120 years since the Chicago fire and the Kerry connection there.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan's.
You're listening to The Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now, today is a significant day because the National Archives of Ireland, they were announcing this last night, that as of midnight last night, a definitive chapter of our history opens. The 1926 census, the first of the Irish Free State, will be available for public search online. For historians, genealogists and the Irish diaspora, these records will reveal the fabric of Irish households and communities at a foundational moment for the nation. Whether you're tracing your lineage or studying a decade of transformation, the stories of a young nation will soon be at your fingertips. So that is a monumental day, and I know a lot of people are very excited about that, and we will be talking more about that in the weeks and months to come. Now, today is the 18th of April, and 120 years ago to the day, I was looking, and I often do this, you know, look at on this day in history and looking at kind of what took place in Ireland and what took place around the world. It's very interesting. There's a lot of websites on it. But I came across this about the Chicago fire. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of Irish people in Chicago at that time. And I came across this article in the IrishEcho.com. San Francisco's population, that's spring morning, was in the region of 400,000 souls. It was said that the Paris of the West, which it was known as, had a bar for each one of them. The great earthquake that was to change everything was unleashed by a shift in hidden tectonic plates just offshore in the Pacific. And this is what led to the fire. And it was, by any standards, a big one, measuring an estimated 8.3 on the Richter scale. The timber radiated outwards from a jolt in the plate, extending almost 300 miles up and down the California coastline. By contrast, the 1989 World Series quake, a 7.1 event, spread itself outwards from a far shorter 25-mile-long shudder in the Earth's crust. There was no television to record the events of 1906, but there were enough photographers about the place to record the aftermath for the historical record. What the photos show is a charred city looking not unlike Hiroshima after the bomb. The streets of 1906 San Francisco were laced underground with gas and water pipes. The quake itself, which lasted just under a minute, caused more than enough damage, but it was the resulting fires that finished the job. Those fires were sparked in large measure by ruptured gas pipes and, of course, similar breaks in the water pipes rendered them useless for firefighting. The best that San Franciscans could do as their city burned was to form bucket brigades. First estimates of the dead placed the figure at about 700. Today, the generally accepted number is 3,000, most of them perishing in the fires. There is no precise record, but the 1906 record remains the greatest in terms of loss of life in US history. It was so strong that the ground shook in Germany. And then I came across a more local connection on the website listolconnection.com. And this is a wonderful website written by Mary Cogan, who retired from teaching and presentation secondary school Listowel, a native of Kanturk. And she has an article from the Kerry Sentinel, Saturday, 19th of May, 1906, so a month after the earthquake and the fire. San Francisco letter from a Kerryman. Mr. Michael Davitt has received the following letter from Mr. Richard C. O'Connor, manager of the Hibernian Bank, San Francisco, one of the best known and most respected Irishmen in that city. Mr. O'Connor, who is a native of Listowel County, Kerry, where many of his relatives still live, has always been a strenuous and generous supporter of the Irish cause. And this letter is dated San Francisco, April 27, 1906, so a few days after the fire and the earthquake. My dear Mr. Davitt, San Francisco, you know, is practically gone. From Van Ness Avenue to the Bay and out Market, Mission and parallel streets to 20th Street is a heap of ruins. Nothing left but a few broken walls that, like grim sentinels of the desert, look down upon nothing but desolation. A few buildings are left standing in this vast district, but their contents are destroyed, except the vaults. Among those left standing are the Palace Hotel, the Crocker Buildings across the street, and the Union Trust Building, the Mutual Bank, the Call Building, the St. Francis Hotel, the Flood Building, the Post Office, the Hibernian Bank were destroyed. Only the walls of this latter building stand, but the vaults are intact. It will give you an idea of the fierceness of the fire when I tell you that the granite broke and apparently melted in our bank. All the Catholic churches are destroyed except a few, very few, in the outlying districts. And so the great, rich, proud city of San Francisco, through whose golden gate the commerce of America passed out to the awakening Orient, is nothing but a heap of broken brick and stone. And the richest city, perhaps in the world, in proportion to its population, is now living on the charity of the rest of the United States. And it is only just to say that their generosity has amply provided everything necessary except shelter. And that is coming in fast, as tents are poured into the city from every direction. And the letter goes on to describe how the city is coping and, you know, how they'll kind of financially kind of address it. And his own family and, you know, how they kind of experience the whole ordeal. And he also mentions another Irish person, and he says, in the fierce fight to stem the advancing tide of flame, I cannot omit mentioning the heroic deed of a gallant son of Tipperary, the Reverend Philip O'Ryan. The cathedral to which he is attached stands facing Van Ness Avenue. On the western side, the Golden Cross surmounting the high tower, glinting in the morning sunlight. The tower took fire and the church was apparently doomed, and with it the entire western addition. This was the only part of the city supplied by water from a system independent of the rest of the city. Father O'Ryan, trained in the athletics of the Gaelic Athletic Association, climbed up the tower inside, had a hose tied to the bell rope which he hauled up, and crawling out, turned the hose on the burning tower, aided by Father Rouen, who shared his peril, succeeded in extinguishing the flames despite the intense heat, which it seemed impossible to withstand. Notwithstanding the ruin wrought and the fortunes that were lost, but one spirit seemed to pervade the people, gratitude that they had survived a fearful catastrophe and a determination to build up a more beautiful San Francisco on the ruins of the old. It's a wonderful letter and it goes into a lot of detail. Listowelconnection.com is where you can find it, and a great website there by Mary Cogan. Now, next Saturday morning, Frank Lewis will be along for his monthly Saturday supplement. And the tagline goes like this: customer refused to drink pint after mouse was removed. Dawn Cora's story in Mallow Castle's home park. A Mallow pub customer of long ago complained there was a mouse in his pint and still refused to drink when the mouse had been removed. This was one of the many tales from the glories and tragedies of Mallow over many centuries, told by local historian Kevin Myers, forestry advisor with Tagus, John Casey, Blackwater fisherman Kevin Healy, and councillor Ronan Sheehan. The stories are told to Frank Lewis of Radio Kerry in Mallow Castle's home park in the hours around sunrise, starting at 5 a.m. and will be broadcast on Radio Kerry from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 25th, next Saturday. Won't that be beautiful to the sounds of the Dawn Chorus, which we were talking about earlier? The glories and tragedies of Mallow over many centuries to the backdrop of the Dawn Chorus are told in the hours around first light in Mallow Castle's home park. So it's on next Saturday from 9 to 11 a.m. That is Frank Lewis on the Saturday Supplement. Now, that's all we have time for on the programme this morning. Thanks a million for tuning in. I really appreciate it every Saturday morning. And my thanks to Abigail Bernard, who was on sound. Pat Kelly is on the way, so keep it here on Radio Kerry. Saturday, 2 weeks, I'll be back again. And remember, we have our monthly In Focus photography slot with Dominic Walsh. The theme is Let There Be Light. So you can email those photos to jmcgill@radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. I'll talk to you again the Maybank holiday weekend. Until then, look after yourself and take care.
90,000 people choose Radio Kerry every week as their station for news, sport and entertainment. Thank you from everyone here at Radio Kerry.